Now to the story of one daring rescue that came out of Iowa. Nancy Baker orchestrated it. She's director of libraries at the University of Iowa, and she's on the phone now, standing behind the sandbags that are protecting the university library in Iowa City. Thanks for joining us, Nancy Baker.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So the rescue took 3 days. Nancy Baker, what did you save?
Well, just a wide assortment of manuscript collections. You know, these are papers of individuals, of organizations. I can't tell you the exact names of everything that came up. We have a whole floor on the third floor of our library now that looks like a bunker because we've moved everything up there. There's just boxes and boxes of manuscripts and archive papers. We also saved film material that we use for cinema classes. Because these are the most easily destroyed in moldy, steamy conditions that you often will have after a flood.
So you saved the library.
Well, I hope so. I mean, we moved as much material as we could possibly save.
Now, I assume there are just thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of books and manuscripts there. How did you do it?
Well, what we did was we put out a call on campus for volunteers, and if you could see right now what I see on this campus where people are sandbagging, and there are literally thousands of people down here from all over the community that are working really hard to save parts of this campus. And the first couple of days we were moving manuscript boxes with our own staff. We could only use about 20 people at a time because they had to come up elevators. They were too heavy to really be lifting, and we needed to use book trucks to get them up. So we were using our own library staff and had plenty of people for that. But when we decided we needed to move some more of these materials out of the basement and up to upper floors, we put out a call on campus, and I can't tell you, hundreds of people showed up hour after hour, for the most part over the course of yesterday through 9 o'clock last night to help us move the materials we had identified as being most at risk. And it just was unbelievable. There were literally rows and rows of human assembly lines passing books up staircases to get them up to higher ground up on the upper floors.
So you did a fire line. You lined people up?
We did a fire line.
Wow.
And we just said, and there were children, there were students from the university, there were faculty members, deans, administrators, all kinds of people from the community who showed up and just worked like mad. Some of them for hours. Others would show up and we'd relieve one crew and do another. I think there were 3 or 4 lines going up the staircases at any one time. It was really just a very moving kind of sight. And actually, I'm down here today, even though we have closed off the building, because people are still showing up to see if they can help. And we wanted to make sure that we could tell them, how much we appreciate them being there, even though we've done what we feel we can do at this point.
Nancy Baker is the director of libraries at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. The rare manuscripts in the university library there are now out of harm's way, we think. Nancy Baker, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yesterday, the pioneer woman helped to win a continent. Today, with the same spirit of determination, American women are working to save this way of life.
Katharine Hepburn in a film reel during the build-up to World War II. For the first time, women were taking a central role in the nation's defense. Rosies, they were called, for Rosie the Riveter. Thousands of workers crawl over the mammoth hulls of Navy ships in dry dock. Women in work overalls, their hair wrapped up in cloth, wield drills, hammers, welding torches. They're outfitting these battleships at a breakneck pace, not a day lost, sending hundreds of ships to the war in the Pacific. This was the scene, 65 years ago, at the shipyards of Richmond, California, just north of Oakland. Today, there's a national park here dedicated to these workers.
I'm standing in Shipyard 3. We can see San Francisco across the bay, but right in front of us is a humongous Victory ship. This is a cargo ship. It's called the Red Oak Victory. It's gray. It's longer than a football field and several stories tall. It's docked here in Shipyard 3.
What I welded was like over here.
Show me.
See, this is called a bulkhead.
Agnes Moore is 88 years old, neck scarf, wavy brown hair. You would never believe this elegant woman was a welder. She points to a line of gray metal along a seam of the red oak.
See the little ridges where you had to oscillate it all the time as you went on up? And then where your rod ended, it always left a bulge like that.
And so you can tell where someone pulled out a new rod.
Yeah.
The Richmond shipyards were a war-building machine in the 1940s. They churned out 747 ships, more than any other U.S. builder during World War II. At the height of production, almost a third of the workers were women.
My name is Marion Nguyen. When I worked here, it was Marion Parsons. And we worked on West Storage, which is a little area just for us, pipe welders.
Nguyen was among the oldest of 11 children. One of her brothers was killed in the war. She came to California from Minnesota.
I wanted to go someplace because we lived in out in the country, and it was a small town, and there wasn't that much to do. You couldn't get a good job, and this was an offer of a good job.
Another part of the national park, a quiet, grassy hill, looks out over the bay. Canada geese fly north. Park Ranger Elizabeth Tucker describes Richmond before America entered the war. There was not a single shipyard here.
So they actually started building the shipyards here in 1940 and building the ships at the same time while they were constructing the shipyard. Of course, when Pearl Harbor happened, a lot more money poured into Richmond. So each year, these shipyards and Richmond itself just kept getting bigger and bigger. So the city of Richmond went from about 24,000 people prior to the war to over 100,000 people.
From every part of the country, people made for Richmond. It was hard work, but they were good-paying jobs, especially for women. Recruitment ads went out from newspapers, televisions, radios.
Friends, it would be impossible for me or for anyone else to overemphasize the importance of women in this war. But even more of us women are needed.
Thank you, Kate Smith.
Agnes Moore was 21 when she heard an ad like that one.
I got all dressed up in my best. You know, I was going to apply for this important job. And I walked in. The receptionist said, we have a lot of openings in the office. I said, no, I want to be a welder. That's an important job, and that's what I want to do.
That's why this is the right place for the Rosie the Riveter Memorial. The National Park's Director of Interpretation is Naomi Torres. She and Park Ranger Tucker lead me to the centerpiece of the park, an enormous metal sculpture jutting up from the ground.
Let's walk through this. What is this thing we're seeing here? This looks like the hull of a ship flipped over so that the keel is up in the air.
That's right, and it is upside down because that's how the ships were built, or at least assembled.
And right over here is a really interesting thing. Women workers were highly valued because they were smaller. And here's an example of a kind of crawl space they would have had to go through to get into the double bottoms of the ship and do all their welding.
So you're right now, Naomi Torres is in a tiny little space in there. Would they have had to get into that little space through this 2 by 1 foot little portal here?
Yes, they would have. I'm about 5'2", and it's still kind of small. And imagine being in here with a welding torch or something like that. I mean, it was really tiny. And this was before all of the safety.
Right, there was no OSHA.
There was no OSHA that existed. And so there were small spaces. There's oral histories we received where they had to go on the sides of the ship and people were held by their ankles.
Oh, my God.
Hanging upside down, welding without any kind of safety measures.
Agnes Moore remembers the dangers of welding ships all day long, especially when she had to weld parts up above her head on the ceiling.
It was hard to keep the metal up there where it belonged.
You had hot slag dripping
on
your
head. Hot metal coming down. It would hit your neck and go right around your shirt collar, which you had everything as tight as you could, but it would still get inside your clothing and burn. So all of us expected that. It just went with the job.
It's stories like this that make the memorial so inspiring, says the park's Naomi Torres.
What people know about is the war. But once you peel back that outer layer, there's all that support that was required to help win the war. And that was what happened here in the home front. And the memorial is about the only thing that remains that recognizes that part of that history.
After the war, most Rosies went back to conventional work. school teachers or homemakers. Coming to this new memorial reminds Agnes Moore not of the hard labor, but of the sense of purpose they felt.
I'm glad that I was able to do something. And I have been told by a Navy man, I want to thank you for saving my life. Well, that took my breath away. And then he went on to explain that he was in Guadalcanal. And he said that their supplies were running low. They didn't have anything to fight the battle with. They knew the Japanese were over on the other side of the mountain. And they thought they were just going to walk right over them. And he said they got up one morning and they looked out on the water. And he said there was every kind of a ship you could imagine, as far as you could see. Just ships everywhere. And he said, we knew then that we were going to make it. And that just really, the idea that he would thank me when he was risking his life. I didn't risk anything. The men that went over there and fought the battles, they're the heroes. I don't consider myself a hero. I just was glad that I could do something that really needed to be done. And everybody else felt the same way. That's just the way we were.
Agnes Moore says she misses that common purpose. She does not miss hot metal dripping from her welding rod, though she can still tell a good weld from a botched one, and she'll show you. Her story and those of other Rosies are archived at the Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historical Park in Richmond, California. Bob and his fellow critics may be giving The Happening the cold shoulder, but the movie is part of a hot trend, the environmental fright flick. NPR's Netta Ulaby takes a look at the latest in eco-horror.
All those deaths in New York and Philadelphia forced The Happening's heroes to join a mass evacuation.
You okay?
I see Boston got hit, too.
Where'd you hear that?
A friend from work. What about Yvette?
Oh, she made it out on the bus.
What the hell is going on, Elliot?
What's happening is an environmental catastrophe. Director M. Night Shyamalan originally called the movie The Green Effect.
Because when I was writing it and I sold it, I hadn't seen Inconvenient Truth yet. And when I saw that, I was like, oh man, this is worse than I thought.
Shyamalan joked that Al Gore's documentary may be the seminal horror film of the century. And an Inconvenient Truth's box office success may be partially responsible for the recent flood of apocalyptic dramas about climate change. Within the past few years, we've had Sunshine, The Day After Tomorrow, and even a CBS miniseries about global warming that had hurricanes sweeping through Chicago and tornadoes tearing through Vegas. Expect remakes soon of movies like The Swarm and Creature from the Black Lagoon that blame pollution and climate change for monstrous mutants. Next year, the science fiction epic Avatar, directed by James Cameron, will depict aliens and humans struggling for ecological survival. Film scholar Kendall Phillips says these movies all have one idea in common.
Somehow the planet has grown tired of us, and we've overstayed our welcome, and something bad is about to happen.
Environmental horror pictures are nothing new. Think Godzilla vs. the Smog Monster from 1971. Phillips says eco-horror was common in the 70s, when moviegoers escaped worries about a gas crisis, with disaster films like Earthquake, and movies about mutant frogs, alligators, and bears. Horror always seems to reflect the anxieties of its time, says scholar Kendall Phillips. But unlike the creature features of the past, today's eco-horror movies, like The Happening, see the whole world as malevolent and vengeful.
It's not that far a stretch from the old haunted house movies in which the house becomes kind of a character. So if you think of the Amityville Horror, now we're just expanding that so that literally the ecosphere plays that kind of menacing role.
Wow, our planet is the haunted house.
The sad truth is that the world is going to become a more and more desperate place. It's going to look more and more like a zombie film as we go along.
Independent filmmaker Larry Fessenden.
That's why I make horror films. I'm trying to say, wake up, people.
Fessenden has been making environmentally themed horror films for years. Animal testing or oil drilling are, to him, ideal subjects for the genre.
I can think of nothing more horrifying than the self-betrayal of destroying the very thing that you love, the very thing that nurtures you. And rather than make films about people killing their mothers, I make films about our sort of indescribable self-contempt that we would destroy the earth that gives us life.
Why wouldn't the wilderness fight us? Like any organism would fend off a virus.
The Last Winter is a Fessenden film that takes place in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. It's set in the near future, and the government has just granted oil company workers permission to drill.
Ever since I got here, I could tell that there was something wrong. Not the job, not the cold, not being isolated. I'm telling you, I've seen something out there in the snow.
Oil is literally the crushed plant and animal life from millennia ago, and now we're burning that. We're burning these corpses, and naturally that suggests sort of a ghostly return, and we're desecrating graves.
Larry Fessenden is now in talks with Leonardo DiCaprio's production company. DiCaprio last year produced a scary environmental documentary of his own, The 11th Hour. Hollywood has a long way to go when it comes to its own environmentalism, says Fessenden. Film sets leave massive carbon footprints. But he hopes that eco-horror can affect the cultural conversation.
We don't want to be in a horror film. We don't want to wake up in a horrible superstorm. We don't want to have wars over the last drops of water. We don't want our shores inundated with environmental refugees. These are all potentially on our horizon. We don't want to live in a horror film. We want to go to them at the movies and then come out and have a sweet and beautiful life.
After all, Fessenden says, what is a horror film but a cautionary tale? Neto Ulibi, NPR News.
You can find reviews of all kinds of summer movies, from horror comedy to a Czech farce to a Werner Herzog documentary, on our website, npr.org. From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Andrea Seabrook. Gas prices. The national average topped $4 a gallon this week. If you commute like I do, you know that hurts. But here's a story that might make you say, at least I don't have it that bad. Dave Givens does. He's an engineer in Northern California. And Dave Givens, how long is your commute?
It's about 186 miles one way.
186 miles one way. How many hours a day do you spend in your car?
About seven.
And I understand you're in your car right now.
Yes, I am.
And you're a record holder?
Well, Midas Muffler Company here a while back ran a nationwide search for America's longest commuter, and I guess I won by 10 miles.
So basically, Dave Givens, you drive the width of California just to get to work each day.
Pretty close.
Describe your commute for us.
Well, I start out about 3:30 in the morning. I arrive at work around between 7:30 and 8, depending on traffic patterns. I try to leave work between 4:30 and 5, and I generally arrive home around 8.
Why do you do that?
Basically, I like my lifestyle. I like where I live. I like my job, and the two just aren't close enough to be compatible with each other.
So you're at home for 2 hours every night.
Yeah, but that's 2 hours of quality time. I was in the Navy, and I spent 11 years at sea out of 13 years, and most of that 11 years was actually gone from home. So it ends up, I'm tired of being separated. So it's worth it to me to come home and, see my wife and pet the dog, see the horses, and enjoy where I live at, even if it's just for a few hours before I go to bed.
Now, it's sort of a perfect storm for you. California has the highest gas prices in the country. AAA says the state's average hit $4.56 a gallon this week. So how much does it cost you to get to work every day?
It generally averages around $50. used to be around, 25, 30 a day. So it's gone up significantly, but it's not the make or break situation yet. It's getting close. It's getting close.
What kind of car do you drive, Dave Givens?
A Honda Accord. When you spend this much time in a car, you got to go for comfort.
So you're not giving this up anytime soon?
It just all depends on the gas prices. If it continues going up and it gets, $4.80, $5 a gallon, then it's definitely going to be a reconsideration. But it's not unreasonable yet. I mean, well, it's unreasonable, but it's not out of the realm of doability yet.
Well, Dave Givens, good luck on your commute.
Okay.
Dave Givens is an engineer in California, and for now at least, he holds the crown of America's longest distance commuter. Our parting words tonight from a man who left his own mark on American history, on politics, and on the media. Longtime newsman of NBC, Tim Russert. He died suddenly yesterday, 2 days before Father's Day. 4 years ago, he wrote his first best-selling book. It was an ode to his own father, titled Big Russ and Me. In it, he describes the moment he decided to write the book. He was accepting an award from the American Legion.
When I asked Dad to come up and accept the award that the Legion had given me, he burst into tears. I was surprised. In my whole life, I had seen Dad cry on only two occasions, at his mother's funeral in 1967 and at his father's 3 years later. But now he was wiping his eyes with the back of his hand. He looked around the dais and saw all these grizzled war veterans, men very much like himself, men who didn't cry very often. And when they saw Dad crying, they started crying too.
Parting words, in his own words, from the late Tim Russert. He died yesterday at age 58, just days after moving his dad into a nursing center. My next guest, Steve Brosnan, doesn't just take the highway to his job. The highway is his job. He's a trucker, and that means long, solitary hours on the road. So when he climbs into his cab and faces down the horizon, he leans over to the stereo and pops in a book. And he's not alone. There's a thriving business in audiobook rentals at truck stops across the country. So this summer, as we look for a little reading inspiration, we'll turn to truckers. We'll get roadside reviews of the best and worst in books on tape. Steve Brosnan joins us from his rig somewhere west of the Mississippi. Steve, where are you?
I'm in Shelby, Montana.
Wonderful. And what are you hauling this week?
Right now, I'm on a wind, what we call a wind project. I'm hauling the blades for the big windmills that are going up.
So what are you listening to these days? I understand you're a fan of a good murder mystery.
Yeah, I like a lot of whodunits and then, the forensics and the science of some of these books. Patricia Cornwell is one of my favorites, and Kathy Reichs is another one. She's got a show on Fox.
Her stories became the show Bones.
Correct, yeah.
So let's start with Kathy Reichs' book, Break No Bones. Do you recommend this?
This particular book? I don't.
Why don't you recommend it? Tell me about the book.
It's a little boring for my taste. I need to be kept interested, and I don't want to be bored with a boring book. This one bored me.
What is it about?
It's about a forensic anthropologist. And she's investigating a Indian burial ground and comes across a body that's a little too fresh for an Indian burial ground. And it opens up into a murder mystery.
We pulled a clip from this, a description of the anthropologist's dinner. Let's listen to this.
Yes.
Cold spiced shrimp, smoked trout, lobster salad, marinated asparagus, brie, pumpernickel squares, tapenade. We ate, watching fingers of sunlight change from yellow to orange to gray. The ocean was calm, a background symphony of swells rolling gently to shore. We finished with key lime pie as the gray turned to black.
Dorothy Berryman reading there. I guess the last thing you want to do is put a trucker to sleep.
No, that's not a good thing out here. You know, between her voice, to me, it was just a little too monotone, and it didn't rise and fall, and I'm not interested in her key lime pie for dinner. That's not why I got the book.
Okay, Steve Brosnan, let's talk about something you did like, something you could recommend to us to pop into our CD players or iPods.
Yeah, the other book was, the Patricia Cornwell book, Book of the Dead. She's investigating a serial killer. She travels over to Italy and tracking this guy and tying the murders together, and it was very good. A couple of discs, you kind of looked over your shoulder and wished you'd get back in the cabin and finish it off and listen to it. It kept you.
So this one was narrated by the actress, Mary Stuart Masterson. Let's listen to a little bit of the first scene of the book. This is the murder scene.
She sits quietly in water, and the water is very cold, with melting ice cubes in it. And there is little in her eyes, nothing much there anymore. At first, her eyes were like hands reaching out to him, begging him to save her. Now her eyes are the bruised blue of dusk. Whatever was in them has almost left. Soon she will sleep.
Now that was the very beginning of the book, and that, to me, that's a hook right off the bat. You know, it kind of threw you a little teaser there, and then it gently got into the characters and the rest of the book. It was well put together. I really enjoyed it.
Well, Steve Brosnan, happy driving, happy listening.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for having me on it. I enjoyed it.
Trucker Steve Brosnan, who goes by the handle Flyboy, has been on the road for more than 30 years. He reviewed Patricia Cornwell's Book of the Dead and Kathy Reich's Break No Bones. We reached him in his truck in Shelby, Montana. For more summer reading recommendations, including good old-fashioned printed books, visit the book section of npr.org.